So we are in the season of Eastertide right now. So Easter is not just a morning, it is a season. It's 50 days long. We do 7 Sundays in which we try to kind of reimagine the world in light of resurrection. And today we're going to try to see if we can tell the truth about this fundamental human problem that around here we have taken to calling the lack. This lack that is within all of us, the sense that something is missing, that we're unfulfilled in essential ways. If something's missing, and it feels like it's always been missing. And what we're missing is not a thing, but a sense of wholeness and completeness. That's the lack. And it's not so much a lack of this or that. It's the self that is lacking. Jacques Lacan called it a lack of being. There's this sense that our very being is it's not whole and complete. And until we find a way to address the lack, we're never going to be okay. We'll be just searching for this missing piece of the self. And the lack inspires the creation of what is often called the sacred object. Like a person, place, or thing, or circumstance that can relieve our sense of lack. The missing piece of the puzzle to our being. And if we just had the sacred object, we wouldn't feel the lack. We'd feel whole and complete. And so it seems essential to us to chase and possess the sacred object that we think can fill the lack. And every culture has different sacred objects. In ours, it's mostly wealth and status. I mean, we'll make religious assertions, but with our lives, most of us behave as though the missing piece of the puzzle is whatever, a bigger house, a promotion, the 401k, a child, a championship, a following. It's different for everybody, but everyone has a sacred object or a few that we feel like if we could obtain it, we would finally feel whole and complete. And all sacred objects have in common at least one thing, and that is that they're unattainable. Because there's always like some barrier that stands between us and the sacred object. And the barrier is part of what makes it sacred. I mean, if you can go to QT and purchase existential wholeness, like how valuable would that actually be, right? So something that easy to get could never fulfill you. So there has to be this barrier or obstacle that stands between us and our sacred object. And only the worthy will, you know, cross the barrier and possess the sacred object. And so this barrier actually produces within us a sense of desire. Desire is longing for something to fill the void and make us whole and complete. And it's kind of odd. It's not actually desire for the sacred or desire the sacred object. It's not the thing producing the desire. There's not so much desire for things that are easy to find, that have no barriers. I mean, you don't see people walking along the beach picking up sand, right? You pick up seashells. There's a barrier there. They're harder to find. There's no barrier. There's no desire for that stuff. It's why some cultures actually still have chaperones go along with their young people when they're dating, when they're courting each other, because they know that a chaperone is a barrier. It's a tremendous source of desire, and they're kind of stimulating desire. They get the couple dreaming about what they could do if this chaperone were just not here, right? That's how it builds desire. That's why flirting stimulates desire. It's just playing with this barrier and inciting this sense of longing. Once you possess the thing, you can no longer desire it. Like even with a person, you can enjoy them, love them. There's pleasure, but not desire, except for the kind of unattainable aspects of them. And so this is just part of our reality. It's just impossible to desire to get something you already possess. We can only desire what we don't have. And so desire requires this barrier, this limit. And it's not the sacred object. It makes us desire. It's the barrier that stands between us and the sacred object. So, for instance, in the story of the garden, when Adam and Eve are there, the forbidden fruit creates the desire. I mean, it's so arbitrary. They can eat of any fruit of the garden, but they can't eat of this one tree. So what do they want? The one tree, right? It's like when you tell your kid you can go anywhere in the house except this room. Where's the one place they want to go? This room, right? This is just, that's all they'll think about, because the barrier creates desire. In fact, if we get too close to our sacred object, we'll often self-sabotage. It's almost always just totally unconscious to us. We don't know that we're doing it. But on some level, we fear that the worst thing that could happen is for us to actually get our sacred object and realize it does not deliver on its promise. And we'll still feel the lack. So we end up being like a dog who desires the bone and gets the bone, but then goes out in the backyard and hides it in a hole and tries not to look at it, you know? So to keep desire alive, we get like this. I mean, this is a real insight into the human condition. We need something to desire. We just need it much more than we need something to possess, which means we need the barrier. We love the barrier. We have so much enjoyment of it. Or desire evaporates. And without desire, we suffer. We get depressed. We struggle. So we have this lack, this sense that we're not whole and complete. And we chase these sacred objects that we think will make us whole and complete, but there's always a barrier that creates this desire, and desire is what makes life kind of move, meaningful, and worth living. There's deep satisfaction in chasing after things that we think will complete us. Possessing things? Not so much, really. But we get tons of enjoyment from chasing after sacred objects that promise to make us whole and complete. Now, this is where I'm going to make you really uncomfortable. Because part of the role that religion plays in human culture is to maintain the barrier between us and our sacred objects. You think about the entire Hebrew religion. It was just constructing barriers between humans and God. Keep God at a safe distance where we cannot have God but desire God. Think about every Christian sect. They all have some different barrier you have to cross, whether it's like, you know, say the sinner's prayer, walk down the aisle, or baptism, or communion, or if you're baptized by the Holy Spirit. They all have some barrier that you have to cross. Religion is often the barrier that stimulates desire for the sacred object. Keeps us longing and striving for the missing thing that will finally complete us and make us whole. And I think Jesus had a deep understanding of this whole situation, of the lack of sacred objects, the role religion plays in fueling desire, because he had this knack for just naming everybody's sacred object. And the way religion was kind of maintaining these barriers. I mean, the whole temple structure of his day, it just had layers and layers of literal barriers standing between the people and God. And he would just call this out all the time. The sacred objects, the barriers. Oh, you guys want to keep the law. That's your sacred object. Or you guys, you want to separate off onto your own, and that's how you maintain the barrier. Or you guys want a messianic figure and a holy war, or you're chasing wealth and political power, and that's all about you trying to control your world. Now, all the Jewish customs of clean and unclean and in and out, these were all barriers that would stimulate their desire for Israel, for God, for whatever, all those sacred objects. And each Jewish sect of the day had kind of different twist on their sacred objects. And Jesus got in a lot of trouble for transgressing the barriers, especially with his rules around, or the Jewish rules around, table fellowship, which is a particular thing. You know, sharing your table, sharing a meal in your home was a deeply religious act in Judaism. It still is, actually, even more so in the ancient world, but even to this day, to share a table is to embrace the one with whom you're sharing the table, to embrace all that they are, like to ratify their beliefs, the way they're living their lives. Sharing a meal, in a sense, it indicated your desire to sustain them, in all that they're doing, in their way of life, to bless that person, to feed them, sustain them, and all they are. So they didn't extend table fellowship to those they saw as a problem, a barrier. Gentiles, the unclean, the sick, Roman sympathizer. I mean, share a table with them would mean that you want to sustain them and all they are with all their problems. And so table fellowship had deep symbolic meaning for the Jewish people. And a big reason Jesus was always in trouble with the Jewish leaders was he kept violating the rules of table fellowship. I mean, the scribes and the Pharisees ask in Luke 5, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? Later in Luke 15, they grumble about him saying, this fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them. He shares a meal with Zacchaeus, the tax collector, the Roman sympathizer, with a woman who, a sinful woman who then anoints his feet and repents. And there's parables about banquets where the rich people don't come. And so it's the poor and the homeless who get to have the feast. I mean, Jesus just kept over and over in his ministry transgressing these barriers around table fellowship, who he would eat with. And he was sort of exposing the game that they were playing with, this lack, this sacred object, this barrier, this desire. One of the biggest sacred objects that they chased was this liberating messianic figure, the anointed one, who was going to come and redeem Israel. And the Messiah would do particular things. He would defeat all their enemies and kind of restore Israel to prominence and then restore right worship in the temple so that God would be always on their side. And Messiah was a very important sacred object that many of them were chasing in that day. In fact, the Pharisees, their belief was if everybody in Israel would just follow the law for a year, Messiah would come, kick out the Romans, and restore Israel. That was their sacred object, which is perfect because it has this built-in barrier. Nobody, they're never going to a whole nation keep the law for a whole year. It's just never going to happen. So it produced this endless desire, or what they called in those days zeal. Each little sect had their own barrier. And Jesus just sort of wrecked that whole situation by violating all the rules of table fellowship, especially. And as he did this, he exposed the reality that everyone struggles with the lack. That there is no such thing as a non-lacking subject, a non-lacking person. Even the Pharisees and Sadducees, the temple rulers, even the high priest, they all had lack. The problem, the barriers, the source of the lack, it's not out there somewhere with some other group who is the problem. It's in here. It's us. It's all of the people. And there's no sacred object that can ever fill the lack. Now, this is usually where the preacher says, you know, there's a hole in your heart, a God-shaped hole in your heart, and God will fill this hole if you, you know, cross some barrier. And I'm not going to say that, because Jesus never said that, for one thing. And in fact, Jesus very clearly struggled with the lack right alongside us, with this reality that something feels like it's missing. But he seemed to think there's no sacred object that'll take it away. And that maybe even there's something about the lack that we all need. That's good for us in the end. Something that God means to use to help us. That maybe even that the lack isn't going away. But these sacred objects we're chasing, these barriers we can keep in place, for sure these are hurting too many people. They're leaving too many people out. And so Messiah cannot be just another sacred object. Messiah is actually here to break down those barriers, kind of expose the illusion. If you read the Gospels, you'll pick up on it. There's this distance between the disciples and Jesus, a disconnect around what they think Messiah ought to be. And they never quite got what he was doing while he was alive. They didn't. I mean, they trusted he was Messiah. They followed his teachings, but they didn't understand what he was doing or saying. Their idea of Messiah was just very different from his. They had hoped he was going to eliminate Israel's problems, but what he did instead was he kept sharing a table with Israel's problems. And much of what he did, it just went against their instincts. But at the same time, he could do these miracles. They were like, I don't know. And just miracles with food, too, like feeding the 5,000, turning water into wine, healing people so that they would be clean and could come back in and share a table with their family. I mean, plus they saw the triumphal entry. They saw him turn the tables, the leaders in the temple. He had this power to restore broken things. It was just so enticing. And so they didn't understand, but they followed him right up to the end until he was killed. And when he died, they were wrecked. Not just the 12, but like around 70 or so who followed him. They were wrecked. His death kind of ruined the game they were playing with Messiah as sacred object. And then, on the third day, started showing up in places, including this one time on the road to Emmaus, where these two disciples, apparently it was dark or something, they couldn't recognize him. And so they start trying to explain the problem of Jesus to Jesus. So they're like, there's this guy who's from Nazareth. He's a powerful prophet and powerful in word and deed, and our leaders put him to death, but we had hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And you guys, the amount of pain and anguish in that little three-word phrase, we had hoped, they had their hopes so up. We had hoped. It's interesting to me that the town of Emmaus has no real significance to the Hebrew story. It's not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible, in the Hebrew scriptures. Nobody famous was from Emmaus. Nothing important ever happened there. Emmaus is basically nowhere, nowhere special. And the story takes place on the first day of the week. Basically, that would be their Monday, the beginning of the work week, the day like everything goes back to normal, just an ordinary day in nowhere special. That's where this happens. They've come from Jerusalem, which is very special. It's the holiest place on earth. And they were part of this group of Jewish followers of Christ who had placed their hopes in him as Messiah. And then he died. And they were secluded in the upper room because it was Sabbath. You couldn't travel. They had to wait until Sabbath was over. But this place, this Jerusalem, this holy city, this kind of religious icon for them, a place that used to be safe, a place they could draw near to God, had suddenly turned against their rabbi, in whom they had placed all of their hopes. And Jerusalem had become an unsafe place, and really just a place of total devastation for this little band of people. So, I mean, think about this with me. They're walking to Emmaus, nowhere special, on the first day of the week, just an ordinary work week. And they're walking away from all of their religious hopes and dreams, from the holy city. Walking away devastated and disillusioned because it wasn't what they thought it was going to be. Does that sound familiar? And they're walking, in a sense, away from Christ and his failure to fill the lack, to be the sacred object they wanted. Their hopes are shattered. We had hoped. So much pain, and we had hoped. And their own people had even turned against them and made them and their guy the bad guy. And they're walking to Emmaus, right, just an ordinary place, back to their ordinary lives, just completely wrecked and brokenhearted. And part of the deep symbolic meaning of the story of the road to Emmaus is that the God who actually is the God who shows up on the road with those who are, in a sense, walking away from failed religion, from their failed sacred objects, their broken dreams for God, for their relationship to God, their dashed hopes of ever feeling whole and complete. The God who is the God who meets us on the road, kind of to nowhere special, as we're trying to pick ourselves up and go back to normal life after our religious dreams have fallen apart. Our hopes have been dashed. And we're walking away. I mean, think about it. They're walking away from their faith community and the failed promises of the religious leaders and their mentors made to them. That's where God shows up, in this place of disappointment and disillusionment and loss. Emmaus is a place that we go in our despair as we're walking away from the thing we thought would finally make us whole and complete. Maybe a faith community, a church, maybe a sacred object, an idea, a belief that let us down. People who attacked us and hurt us and the ones we love. Emmaus is where we go. And everything we thought would give our lives like meaning and purpose has collapsed. And suddenly, like the person that we thought we were and the person we were trying so hard to become feels like it's just shattered into a million pieces, and we don't know who we are anymore or who to trust. Emmaus is where we go when the people that we trusted to lead and guide us have been exposed as untrustworthy or deceived, when our own community has kind of pushed us aside or let us down, when we feel attacked, when we feel like we just have to go into hiding. Emmaus is where we go. When everything we thought we knew about God has kind of vanished, and all that's left are rumors about angels and an empty tomb. And we're curious, and we want to know more, but we have to go back and punch the clock and get back to it on this sad and lonely, depressing Monday for them. That's Emmaus. It's the road we walk amidst the wreckage of all the hopes and dreams that don't pan out. One of my favorite writers, Frederick Buechner, he writes about Emmaus. He says this. He says, Emmaus is a place we go in order to escape. A bar, a movie, wherever it is, we throw up our hands and say, let the whole damn thing go hang. It makes no difference. Emmaus can be a trip to the movies for the sake of just seeing a movie, or to a cocktail party just for the sake of cocktails. Emmaus might be buying a new suit or a new car, or smoking more cigarettes than you really want, or reading a second-rate novel, or even writing one. He wrote novels. Emmaus may be going to church on Sunday. Emmaus is whatever we do or wherever we go to make ourselves forget that the world holds nothing sacred, and that even the wisest and bravest and loveliest decay and die. That even the noblest ideas that men have had, ideas about love and freedom and justice, have always, in time, been twisted out of shape by selfish men for selfish ends. Emmaus is where we go, where those two went, he says, to try and forget about Jesus and the greatest failure of his life. I mean, this is where they were. This is how they saw it on the road to Emmaus. Jesus had failed to live up to their hopes. Emmaus is wherever we face the tough reality that the life we've been chasing isn't what we thought. And we don't know who we are, kind of where we are, who God is, and we sort of fall down, we sort of break down, we just lose it and throw up our hands and say, forget this, forget you, forget God even. And here's the twist, and this is it, you guys. I mean, this is the radical core of Christianity in light of resurrection. We think that giving up like this is some kind of failure or lack of faith. that's a problem. But that's the moment. That's kind of the necessary precondition for the miracle to happen. God shows up on the road to Emmaus. And they don't even know him at first. They don't recognize it. But resurrection happens to these two guys who quit. Life springs from death, sort of in the last place you'd expected, on the very day when it all falls apart and we give up. That's what the story says. The place where God finally becomes real and knowable is in our road to Emmaus. It says that one of the disciples is unnamed. I think this is a signal, like insert name here. God meets us on this road too, where our hopes and dreams don't pan out. And it tells us that God is the God who meets us on that road of disillusionment. And one of the deep themes of this story is that it's not until we failed and washed out and given up on our religious projects. It's not until we've like just turned and walked away from them. From everything we've held sacred and thought was holy and we're just sure it was going to work. That's when God shows up. And he meets him on this road of unmet desire and the loss of self and even the loss of God. And this is a place that's kind of beyond sentimentality, you know? And certainly beyond certitude. When they dropped all their pretension, that's when God shows up. Just to listen, talk with him, lament with them, hear about their loss. And then he does an interesting thing. It's a very interesting detail. He begins to reinterpret their story. He re-narrates it. It's the same word as hermeneutics, interpretation. He reinterprets their lives for them. And this is huge. Part of what this means is that the meaning of our traumas is never fixed. You ever think about that? We get to re-narrate them. We get to give them new meanings that we assign, that we choose. That's resurrection, man. This is what Jesus begins to do. He's like, I know this happened to you, but let's re-narrate the whole story. And as he does this, they start to feel what they used to feel when they were with Christ. And apparently they don't want to end, so they're like, you might as well stay, have a little dinner. And it's as they sit and share a meal, table fellowship, their eyes are open. They could see it was Jesus. And afterwards they would say, were not our hearts burning within us when he was talking with us on the road? Like, how do we not know? Of course, it was him. And then, you know, of course they felt the joy they used to feel when they were with him, but they made this leap, like a leap they couldn't make before, that actually, when they were with Jesus, they were with God. God was somehow present to them through him. It's just a thought they couldn't think until they gave up on it ever happening. The Spirit of God was there, shining through Christ, living through Christ. And don't miss the detail that in this story, they don't know he is. He's not revealed until they're breaking bread, sharing table fellowship. This radical center of Christ's ministry. It's only in turning together in the same kind of friendship he did that they finally recognize it's Christ, and Christ is this conduit to the divine. Or you could say they only recognize Jesus in the living like Jesus. They live as he lives, sharing a table in friendship. That's when God happens after resurrection. Jesus said, whenever two or three are gathered, I'll be there. The Spirit of God will be there. If you're hooked up together and trying to do life in my name, God happens. God appears. And then this weird thing happens. The moment they realize who it is, he vanishes, which is a crazy detail, but it makes sense. You know, no barrier, no desire. He's not going to become just a sacred object they can possess and control. They can contain in some religious experience. I mean, if Jesus just stuck around, they would have turned him into a carnival freak, you know, and charged tickets. they'll start demanding things of him, like a genie in a bottle, and eventually they'd put up their own barriers and make him inaccessible so they could be filled with their desire again and keep chasing after him. And so he hides from us. He refuses to play that game. He disappears, and he'll show up in a different way. And that's kind of where the story leaves us. That all that's really left after he disappears is this revelation that God happens not when we find the sacred object and solve the lack. God happens when we live as Jesus lived, which is mostly about table fellowship, living as neighbors with broken people, pouring out our lives for each other, welcoming the outsiders, ones who don't fit in, the ones that we are tempted to think are the problem, sharing a table even with our enemies until they're friends. The most revolutionary aspect of Jesus' teaching is that he just refused to become their sacred object or give them one. He didn't play that game. In fact, he didn't leave beliefs or doctrines or a bunch of laws or rules. He left no idols, no shrines, no writings. All he left was this community who had learned to live as he lived, who had discovered God in their midst, living through the other as they pour out their lives. And part of what we learn from this is there's no sacred object that isn't a scam. The lack is never going away. Nothing will ever fill it. It's just part of what it means to be human. Nothing will fill it. Sooner or later, everything we try will fall apart. And all we can do is look for Jesus on the road home from all our broken dreams and stay in the pain and the lack and let that pain and that lack turn us toward each other. Other broken people traveling with the same disappointment. And then God happens. I think in all of the New Testament, this is one of my favorite stories. Because I think it names something true about my life. I mean, I've been a Christian as long as I can remember, and I'm not messing around. Like, I went pro at being a Christian. And the truth is, I struggle with the lack as much as anybody. And I am often unfulfilled in my life. And I search for meaning in ridiculous things, laughable things. And I have often turned to God to fill the void in my life and to like work for a while, or I convince myself it is. And then I get delusioned or angry and it stops working. And I blame myself for others. I put my trust in people who have hurt me and left me, who have blamed me and attacked me. I've struggled not to become bitter in the wake of it. I bear the scars not only of my own failure, but other people's too. We all do. People we loved, people we thought we could trust. And I could give you a whole long, ridiculous list of sacred objects, things I chase to try and fill the lack. And yet, I still feel empty sometimes and filled with doubt and unmet longings. I still feel lonely when I'm with other people. And I struggle with this feeling that something is missing. That something's wrong, you know? That something essential is lacking. And I sit with you guys and I know you feel it too. And no matter the religious things that we try, we're going to wake up most days feeling more lost than found. That's the lack. But I'm just wagering my whole life that Jesus is right, that he was telling the truth, and he was leading his followers to a truthful place, in a place that's human and humane and humanizing, that if we'll stop trying to jump through hoops to get what we desire, if we'll not use religion as a way to try and end our sense of lack, if we'll just confess it and own it and learn to talk about it and maybe even laugh about it, that God can happen to even us. that the pain and the tension of it all, what it does more for us more than any other thing is it turns us to each other. And we just kind of go, help. And then God shines through this other image-bearing creature, and I know I'm not alone. This is why the lack is never going away. The lack is there to turn us toward each other. And this is where God happens. Anytime two or three are gathered doing life in his name, God's spirit comes. And then it disappears. It goes away again. We're like, where'd it go? And then the lack happens and we fumble around and screw it up. And then we confess it and go, help. And then God happens. And we recognize it's happening and then he disappears. This is the way it goes. But all of this happens in ordinary life. On the way back to work, to wait in no place special. God happens like after our failed attempts to be religious, to find wholeness. And I think that at this place, I see it happening all the time. I see people telling the truth and just saying, help. And ouch, and becoming a little more human. And I wouldn't trade this for anything. So I hope you'll join me, stay with me on the road to Emmaus, our road, because I think we'll find God's presence there, walking with us, leading us. Amen? Yeah, let's pray. God, we just confess that we feel the lack and we hate it. But we pray that through your grace and just your love and your constant presence with us, holding us and moving us into the world, that we'll let it turn us toward each other and we'll find you waiting there for us. It's hard to believe sometimes, and we get so sidetracked looking to fill the lack with sacred objects. But I just pray that we'd stay in it, and we'd let it turn us to each other, and we'd find you there for us. Thank you so much for this story, including it in our scriptures so we could talk about it today. Amen. I invite you to stand, please.